children down, come down in the front pews. They're welcome to, but everybody seems to be pretty grouped down here. But if anybody wants to come down a little bit closer, they can. That's up to you. Question that I often get, especially from homeschool parents, that's about the only people I ever talk to anyway, but I'm trying to think if I know anybody who isn't. I probably don't. Not George anyway. One of the questions I often get is, my son wants to go in the military. Military forces. Military, by the way, is an adjective, not a noun. And they say, well, we don't want him to, because the devil controls the military forces, or this is a terrible time, etc. And so I'm always being asked for advice and consent. And often an 18-year-old young man will come to me and say, I want to join the Army, but my parents are against it. Would you talk to them? Well, we'll all talk together. And what I typically say is, let's look at the Scriptures, see what the Scripture says. Does the Bible call men? Do we see in the Scriptures evidences of God calling men to military service? The answer is yes, all over the place. And then we ask the question, is it possible that God still calls young men to military service today? Well, I know dozens of wonderful, great Christian men in our armed forces. And no question what God has called them to serve military. And, of course, it goes beyond that. It goes past that to the point of, you know, whatever your calling is, you're going to be in the world. You're going to be faced with attempts to force you to compromise your convictions. And I tell them, if you're going to go in American military service, just be aware that there is a, more than ever before, a high probability you'll be called upon to compromise your Christian faith. And you just have to realize that when that happens, you have to stand for Christ. For he is the ultimate authority. Not the President of the United States, not your commanding officer. You have a prior commitment to obedience to the Lord Jesus Christ. So if you go in the Army or any of the military branches and you're called upon to compromise, you have to stand. You have to stand fast for Christ. And you have to be willing to take the consequences of that. And it's the same in business. I mean, I don't know any businessmen who have never been tempted or ordered to compromise their convictions. It happens all the time. And sometimes a businessman who takes a stand for his faith pays for it by losing his job or not getting a promotion or what have you. So it's the same wherever you go. You have to be willing to suffer the consequences of standing for Christ. And it may be worse in military service than in business. Or the Lord may smooth your path through, which has happened to some men. So it's obvious to me in history that God has used men in military service to further his purposes and to advance his kingdom in number of unique ways. That does not mean that your young man is called to serve military. Every case is different, and how God works in individual families is different in every family, so I'm not making any blanket statements. But to say this, that God has raised up military leaders in the past to do great things. And he's raised up reprobate and evil military men to fulfill his purposes. We see it all through the Scripture. But this morning I would like to talk to you about a man who was not a born military officer. He was not a career officer. He didn't determine to go into the armed forces at an early age. Providence directed him into a certain path at a certain point in history in which he suddenly rose to the top and became one of the great generals of history. His name was Oliver Cromwell. In fact, Oliver Cromwell's right over here, and I don't think it's a particularly flattering picture of him, but he's in his. There are many images of Cromwell in his uniform. So this morning I'd like to talk to you about him. First, I'd like to read a verse of scripture, a couple of verses from Joshua chapter 11. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid because of them, for tomorrow at this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire." So Joshua and all the people of war with him came upon them suddenly by the waters of Merom and attacked them. The Lord delivered them into the hands of Israel so that they defeated them and pursued them as far as the great Sidon and Rizaphath Maim and the valley of Mizpah to the east, and they struck them until no survivor was left to them. Joshua was called to be a general, field marshal, in fact, in the Lord's army, and given the task of, in some cases, exterminating the Canaanitish enemies. And the example of Joshua was one that Puritans often called upon when they talked about Oliver Cromwell and when they thought of Oliver Cromwell and what he was called upon to do. He was a modern Joshua in a number of ways. But Oliver Cromwell, like all people in history, was a sinner. And he had weaknesses and problems and foibles and enemies. And we can say that of all the great Christian men of history. They all have one thing in common. That is, they are all sinners in need of redemption by Christ. And so they have weaknesses and follies just like everyone else. Perhaps less so than everyone else. But Oliver Cromwell himself was one of the most remarkable characters in world history. And he came at a particular time in which England's civilization needed to be saved for Christendom, for reformed Christianity. And he was the man of the hour, the man on the spot. Oliver Cromwell lived to be 59 years old. He was born in 1599. Died in 1658. He came from the gentry of England. That is, he came from a family that was fairly well-to-do. He probably thought throughout his early years that he had a career as a gentleman farmer around Huntington. And eventually he was able to acquire property and be elected or appointed to serve in the Parliament. A person who serves in the Parliament of England is called an MP, Member of Parliament. And so he became an MP in the Long Parliament and in the Short Parliament too, I think, both of them. And there he was representing his particular district as one of the other members of Parliament, except that when Oliver Cromwell was called to become this politician, something else occurred at the same time, and he determined to do his bit, not for king and country, against king, for country. And as it turned out, he was a man destined for greatness as a general. I mentioned the background to the English Civil War yesterday. Now, a civil war is where people of the same country go to war with each other, and they fight against each other for supremacy, that is, for the leadership of the nation. It's where, in this case, the king carries his standards, his flags, out to Nottingham, which is an area that symbolizes royal authority. He planted his flags there, and he declared war on Parliament. In essence, he declared war on England from the parliamentary perspective, but he saw Parliament as being traitorous and as being opposed to the monarchy, which they really weren't opposed to the monarchy. They actually were opposed to Charles I and his high-handed tyranny and tyrannical laws that he was trying to force on the nation. And so the king, God raises up good kings, and sometimes he raises up bad kings, and sometimes kings are mixed, partly good, partly bad. And in this particular case, the king was being opposed by the men who made the laws of the country. And so he declared war on them, which is a very unusual thing for a king to do. I can't remember another case in England's history where this happened. I think it's the only time where the king declared war on his own people. But he did. Now, the country of England, it's an island. And at the time, the population were several million people. And they divided into three different parts. One part supported the king. One part of the country people liked the king. And they believed that he was God's anointed. And they supported whatever he wanted to do, even if it was bad. These were people who had the idea that he's my king, and whether he is good or evil, I will support him because God made him king. Well, those people supported the king. And then a third of the people, some other of the people, they supported the other side. They supported the parliament. And they said that the king has to obey the laws of God. And if the king doesn't obey God, then he can't have authority over us. And they said he's broken the laws of God, and he's declared war on his own people. So he no longer gets to have our allegiance. And we no longer have to obey the king because he is a tyrant. And there were some books that had been written prior to this that people had read, in which godly men had argued from the Bible that if a ruler violates the rules that God set down to be a king, then they didn't have to obey him anymore. And one of those books was called Lex Rex. It means the law is king, in which a Scottish, he's over there on the table, a great Scottish preacher named Samuel Rutherford wrote that God established the rules for monarchy, for kings. And if they become tyrants, the people don't have to obey them anymore. And so he wrote this book, Lex Rex, and King Charles I burned the book. He had public book burnings. And his son, Charles II, is going to have book burnings of Samuel Rutherford's book, too. They hated the ideas that were put in this book. Books can be very, very powerful. Books can present arguments that make people so angry that they're willing to destroy the book, to burn the book, as if that will get rid of the ideas behind it. And that was a popular thing to do back in those days. And every once in a while, a king would have book burnings of things that he didn't like. Martin Luther had all of his books and everything he ever wrote burned over and over again. But there were so many of them out there that the kings and the priests could not burn enough of them to get rid of the ideas and to get rid of those things. There have even been people in history who have burned the Bible. They hate the Bible so much that they burn the Bible to try and get rid of God's word, which is a foolish thing to do. Well, anyway, the king declared war on Parliament, and these men of Parliament who read Lex Rex and other books that have been written about tyranny and the rights of the subjugated, and they decided to defend themselves against the king's army. Now, at this time in history, England did not have an army. Now, what do you think about that? Here you have a country that has to survive against all those enemies out there, France and Spain. Spain, in fact, is the greatest nation in the world at the time. Spain has the only standing professional army in Europe. The Spanish army is big and powerful. The previous century, the 1500s, is called the Spanish century. Those are the years of the Reformation. But from an overall historical perspective, Spain dominated the world. And they had a large standing professional army that were professionally trained. Most countries, when they went to war with other countries, they hired their armies. They went out and paid money to men who were professional soldiers from Switzerland or from Venice or Genoa in Italy. Or they purchased professional soldiers from Germany or some other place. Now, eventually, some of those soldiers are going to be from Scotland. And at this period of history, in the mid-1600s, there are a lot of Scottish young men who have sold their military services to a great Christian king in Europe, in Sweden. And his name was Gustavus Adolphus. And he has raised an army and trained them to fight against the armies of the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, and the Catholic armies of Europe. So during the English Civil War, there's another war going on in Europe. And it's a war between Protestants and Catholics, generally speaking. Now, that's a gross oversimplification, because some Protestants fought for Charles V. And some Catholics fought on the side of the Lutherans and the Calvinists. So it's a mixed up thing. But this is the time period in which professional armies are being trained to fight for their nation. And Gustavus Adolphus has made the greatest army in the world. So when this war takes place in England, this civil war, and they don't have a standing army, what Oliver Cromwell and Parliament and the king do is they look to Gustavus Adolphus, the great Protestant Christian prince who's been fighting for years in Sweden, and also a prince from the Netherlands by the name of Maurus. And between he and Gustavus Adolphus, they have developed a way of fighting that's the best way in the world. And they win battle after battle after battle. And a lot of their soldiers are from England and from Scotland, young men who didn't have anything better to do. And so they sold their services to these professional fighting companies who then went and were hired by Sweden or the Netherlands or someone else. France would hire Catholic soldiers and they would fight in the wars of Europe. Well, with the English Civil War, Parliament and the king hired some of these men back, had them come back and train their soldiers to fight in the English Civil War. So it was at the very beginning, the English Civil War is what the English themselves would call a great muddle. It was mobs of citizens who were now armed and given uniforms and very basic rudimentary training and then sent off to fight each other. But some of their leaders were skilled men who'd come over from Europe. The king had a special soldier with him. It was his nephew. And he had been fighting in the wars in Europe. And he was a dashing figure. His name was Prince Rupert. And he came over from the continent and said that he would fight for his Uncle Charles. I don't know if he called him Uncle Charlie or not. Probably behind his back he called him Uncle Charlie. But anyway, Prince Rupert came, and Prince Rupert wore the coolest uniforms, big floppy hats with feathers. He rode on a gigantic horse, a war horse, that was not afraid of going into battle. And he wore a flashy red uniform, a red jacket, and he was young and handsome, and he had his own troop that he raised of men who rode horses, and they fought with swords. And the way Prince Rupert liked to fight was, as soon as the battle started, he would charge as fast as he could with all of his horsemen and try to run over their enemy. And he was successful at it, and he served the king. The problem with Prince Rupert and his soldiers was that they didn't have self-discipline. That is, they didn't know when to stop. And once they ran over an enemy army, they kept on going. And sometimes they would gallop for miles and miles looking for the wagon trains and the baggage of the opposing army so that they could loot it and get riches and steal all their stuff. And so Prince Rupert's men were undisciplined, and they always wanted, they were in it to see how much loot, how much they could steal from the enemy army after they defeated them. Prince Rupert is going to go up against the cavalry, the men on horse of the Parliament's army. And the men on horse of the Parliament's army are going to be led by Oliver Cromwell. Well, when the Civil War started, Oliver Cromwell resigned his seat in the Parliament, and he went home, and he put the word out to his neighbors that he was going to raise a company of cavalry to fight for Parliament. And Oliver Cromwell was an extremely unusual man for his day, in that he took very seriously the commands of the Bible. He decided that the best way to have an army that was disciplined and that was self-disciplined, that would obey orders, that would do what they're told, was to have officers commanding the men who were Christians. And there was another unusual thing that he did. He didn't care what church they went to. Now, in the king's army, all the officers, of course, belonged to the Church of England. All of them were noblemen. They were men who didn't work for a living. They inherited their living. The definition of an English gentleman is a man who can wear kid gloves, who can wear white gloves, and they'll never get dirty because he doesn't work with his hands. Well, those are the kinds of men that the king had around him. Oliver Cromwell, who was just a member of Parliament and was just going to raise a company of cavalry, he wanted the best men for the job. He didn't want the richest men. He didn't want men who wore kid gloves that didn't want them to get dirty. He wanted men who would fight and who would obey orders without question, who would do what he said and what his officers would say. And he wanted men who were godly. He wanted men who prayed regularly to God for help. He wanted men who did not curse God's name. And in fact, in his troop that he raised, if someone cursed God's name, they would be fined. And because most of the men that actually served in the ranks were not wealthy men, a fine was a very difficult thing to pay. A fine is where they require you to pay money, like taxes. Taxes, in a way, are a fine for living. But the army of Oliver Cromwell could be fined for cursing God's name, for disobeying orders. If they disobeyed orders, they could be hanged, could be executed for disobeying orders. He did not allow them to gamble their money away. Soldiers are notorious for gambling. That is, playing card games in which money is at stake. He didn't want his men to be doing things that he believed that God did not like. In fact, the men of the Parliament's army had a nickname, and it was almost like a curse. And it made Oliver Cromwell so angry that he would fine his own men if they called themselves this. And that is roundheads. If they use that word, Oliver Cromwell would fine them money for using that term. But the two armies were called the Roundheads and the Cavaliers. The king's army took upon themselves the name of Cavalier. Now, isn't that a wonderful term? They had, and you could tell the difference between them, because many of the king's soldiers, especially the officers, had real long hair. And they wore jaunty uniforms. They arrived on the battlefield to see and to be seen. The parliamentary army, especially Cromwell's men, he had them cut their hair short. And of course, they wore leather helmets or sometimes the metal bassinet helmet. And they were called roundheads by the cavaliers in derision, like Puritan. And they were all Puritans, of course, that were in the Parliament's army. But those who fought for Oliver Cromwell were of a different stripe than other soldiers in Parliament's army. Cromwell's men were men that were going to be personally, in their personal lives, godly men first. And then they were going to be highly trained soldiers, because he brought in the best men to train them. Men who had served under Gustavus Adolphus and Prince Maurice of the Netherlands. He brought veterans from the European War to help train his men. And he himself was just a farmer, a gentleman farmer, say the least. But Oliver Cromwell took to war like a duck takes to water. In fact, they said that when Oliver Cromwell went into battle, there was a joy on his face that no one could explain. He would be singing the Psalms as his men charged on horseback into battle. It's interesting, in our own history, in American history, there are those who likened a Confederate general named Stonewall Jackson to Cromwell. In fact, he was called the American Cromwell. A number of times the parallels were drawn. Godly men who commanded other men who were godly men too, to a large extent anyway. And for some reason, when they got into battle, they were in their element. God had given them a gift for fighting. And Oliver Cromwell was one of those men. Just an upcountry farmer who, when his moment came, turned out to be a really great soldier. So he started out with just commanding a company of cavalrymen. But he trained them to do something that the king's general didn't do, that Prince Rupert didn't do. And that was to keep his men under control. Once the clash of battle happened, once the cavalry charged each other and smashed into each other on horseback, and Cromwell's men carried pistols, as many as they could cram in their belts, and swords. And they would sometimes even carry short muskets, because they had to fight on horseback. And it's called a melee, when the two sides get together and the horses are all rearing and you're trying to pick out who your enemy is and fight them with your sword or shoot them with your pistol. That's the way the cavalry battles were conducted. But they would charge into each other and crash, and the horses would go down, and it was a huge, confusing, chaotic mess in battle. Well, he taught his men how to keep their saddles. In fact, Oliver Cromwell realized that if cavalry were going to be successful on the battlefield, the men had to be on the best horses. Oliver Cromwell was also called the greatest horse thief in British history, because wherever the Parliament's army went, Cromwell was out there scouring the countryside for the best horses. And his men knew they had to be well mounted if they were going to be successful. So his men got the best horses in England. They paid very close attention to their horses, and they took care of their horses. If a horse is going to carry you into battle, he better be a good horse that's going to obey, but he needs to be fast, and he needs not to run away if you get thrown out of the saddle. He needs to wait for you to get back on, or you got a problem. And so they got the best horses they could find, horses that would fight in the battle. And battles are so loud, with all the gunfire and the cannons were so loud, you can't imagine how loud a battlefield was. So it's confusing. You can't hear orders. You can't hear what your officers are telling you. It's too loud. And in those days, when they fired muskets, you know, when the infantry closed and they were firing muskets, the gunpowder was put out so much smoke that you could not even see the battlefield. And so a lot of times they're fighting in the middle of all this smoke, and it's so loud you can't hear anything. And if your officer has been shot off his horse, You have to be able to do the right thing, even though there's nobody screaming in your ear to tell you what to do. Well, that's how Oliver Cromwell trained his men, so that they would know what to do if it became confusing or too loud or they couldn't see each other. Each man knew what his duty was. So he would do his duty on the battlefield, even though everybody else was losing their heads or it was so confusing they didn't know what to do. And that's how he trained his men. He also trained his men to not keep on going like Prince Rupert's men did. Don't go through the enemy and then continue on to his baggage to try and steal his stuff. Because the battle is about winning, not about enriching ourselves. We're fighting for the Lord. That's what Oliver Cromwell said. We're fighting for God's glory, not for our glory. And there was no other group in either army that had the kind of leadership that Oliver Cromwell offered his men and the officers he picked. In fact, the other men in the Parliament's army, they looked down on Cromwell's men because many of them were not gentlemen. Some of them were professional soldiers. Some of them were tenant farmers who had leadership skills that he would recognize and make them captains. And there were captains among the captains of the king's men, and most of the other parliamentary captains were all big landowners. They were wealthy men who could raise a company of cavalry. And some of Cromwell's men were not. And some of them were. It was a mixture. He went after the men who could do the best job. And so, thank you. I also don't know what time it is. So someone's going to need to loan me a watch again. Thank you. Ooh, our time is flying. As the English Civil War progressed, Oliver Cromwell rose through the ranks and more men came to serve with him. And he was given command of larger bodies of troops by the parliamentary commanders, Lord Fairfax and others. The Parliament's army won a number of significant great battles, and the strategies of the English Civil War were fairly simple, the overall plan for the war. The king had to capture London. That's pretty much it. And he couldn't do it. London was highly defended and defensible. He did not have the engines that you needed to lay siege to a big city. Remember, England didn't have a standing army, so they didn't have big engines of war that would knock down walls. And so they had to fight it out in the fields and see who could win. So the battles of the English Civil War are going to be fought out in the fields. Now, the king's army captures Puritan cities and towns, sometimes massacres the people. Civil wars are ugly, brutal things. And the king's forces won a number of battles. Parliament's forces won a number of battles. But Parliament's forces won the big ones, the most important battles, the kind that wrecked the king's army so badly that he couldn't recover. And that happened at least two times, at Marston Moor and at the Battle of Naseby, which is the conclusive battle of the First English Civil War, Battle of Naseby. In the Battle of Naseby, Oliver Cromwell once again rises to the top. Now, the way the battles were fought, you might find this interesting. Usually, the battles were decided by the infantry, that is, the men on foot. And there were basically two kinds of foot soldiers. The kind that carried pikes, which were real long poles with a blade on the end, or a point, or a hatchet. There were different kinds of pikes. But the pikemen would be on the flanks, or actually would be in the center, and on the flanks of the pikemen would be the musketeers. And these were the men who carried the muskets. And they had the long metal piece that they'd stick in the ground, and they would rest the musket on the bipod, and they would load and fire by command And that's what made all the smoke go out into the field. And then the two sides would clash together with the pikemen trying to chop each other up. And once they got inside, the lengths, the poles of the pikes, then the men drew their swords and knives and they fought hand to hand in close. The cavalry were on the wings. And if the cavalry were successful, they could come in on the flanks, on the sides of the men on the ground. And men on the ground don't do very good against cavalry, especially if the lines have been broken and everybody's just running around. The cavalry can ride them down and put them to the sword very easily. So the cavalry could be the decisive arm in a battle in those days. And that's what Cromwell's men were. They were decisive. They made the difference. They ran Prince Rupert's men off the field. Actually, Prince Rupert's men ran themselves off the field and didn't get back in time. But Cromwell's men were trained that once all the fighting with the cavalry started to dissipate, started to change, then they would all gather. They would regather. They would find where their standards were, and they would gather the men there. Cromwell would then lead them against the infantry on the flanks. And when he did that, he broke the king's army. Eventually, the First English Civil War wound down, started to come to an end. And Parliament had been pretty successful. The king was still in the field. He still had his army. Parliament had won some of the significant battles, but they really didn't have order. They still didn't have a general that could win a decisive battle and put an end to the war. So Parliament passed a rule. And this rule, this law, was proposed by Oliver Cromwell himself. Cromwell wanted the parliamentary army. He had an idea for it, what he called the model that the army should be. And what Parliament did is they passed a law that said no member of Parliament can serve in the army. Well, that got rid of all the generals, including Cromwell himself. And then they passed a law exempting Cromwell from the law. And so he and Lord Fairfax and several other men created what became known as the New Model Army. And they took what Cromwell had created with his cavalry and they applied the rules to the whole army and put Cromwell in charge. So Cromwell became the commander of all the parliamentary forces. Actually, there was one general over him, but Cromwell was really in control and in charge. And they built up an army which became known as the New Model Army, and it became the greatest army in Europe. And after the English Civil War, the New Model Army and the New Model Navy, under Oliver Cromwell as well, became so feared that all Cromwell had to do when he was the Lord Protector was to threaten to invade a country with the New Model Army, and they would do whatever he said. And as a matter of fact, when he was the Lord Protector, which I'll tell you about very quickly in just a moment, when he was the Lord Protector, the Waldensians were being massacred in France, and they were Christians, and they were part of the Reformation, had become part of the Reformation. And they petitioned Cromwell to save them, to help them. And Cromwell sent an open letter so that the Pope would read it. And the letter said essentially to the Pope, withdraw all the Catholic forces who are massacring the Waldensians, or I'm going to bring the New Model Army to Italy, and then we'll see how good the Vatican troops are. And the Pope called off the dogs, and the Waldensians were left alone. They didn't want Oliver Cromwell running amok in Italy or anywhere else on the continent. That's how ferocious the reputation was of the New Model Army of England. He created the English army that for the next three centuries is going to dominate in many ways all across the British Empire. He also invented the red uniform, the russet coat. He said, I would rather have a russet-coated captain than a lord. Men who just wore kind of their normal work clothes. And he developed this russet coat, this red coat, that eventually evolved into the red uniforms of the British Army. And so the red coats from henceforth are going to be renowned around the world for their military prowess. It all began with the New Model Army and Oliver Cromwell. Well, eventually the Parliamentary Army won the war. They won the English Civil War. They actually had to fight a couple different civil wars because the king refused to capitulate. He continued. He had to surrender. But even so, he began intriguing, that is, making secret plans with armies from other countries, especially from Ireland. Now, the thing about armies in Ireland at this time is they're Catholic armies. And the king is secretly working to get French troops and Irish troops to come to England to fight for him. Catholic armies to be brought in to fight against the Puritans. And when Parliament found out about it, when they found out that the king was trying to purchase armies to come into England, foreign armies to come into England to fight against the people, they put him on trial for treason against England. And he was found guilty, and he had his head chopped off. And as Pastor Moorcraft says, Charles I did not like his severance package. And he was no longer the king. Well, now England had no king. Charles I had a son, Charles, who was in exile in France. And there are those who said, we need to bring Charles from France and make him the new king of England. Parliament said, no, we don't want to do that. And in the end, after a lot of other things took place, they chose Oliver Cromwell to lead England. And they said, we want to make you the king of England. And Oliver Cromwell laughed at them. He said, I am no king, and I'm not destined to be the king of England at all. In the end, he agreed to become what he called the Lord Protector of England. Now, he functioned like a king. His will was what guided the kingdom. Oliver Cromwell became the Lord Protector, not the King of England. As the Lord Protector, he had to fight. He had to continue to fight. He had to go to Ireland and quell the rebellions against his authority in Ireland. He had to send his fleet, the New Model fleet, he had to send them to Norfolk, Virginia, because the governor of Virginia was a royalist and did not recognize Oliver Cromwell. And so he sent the English fleet to Norfolk and told the royal governor that they were going to go up and they were going to bombard Jamestown and Yorktown, and they were going to destroy Norfolk. And suddenly the governor of Virginia realized that Oliver Cromwell was the Lord Protector and agreed to it. And so they did not bombard Virginia, but they did fight Spain and defeat them, France and defeat them, fought the Dutch, had to fight the Dutch one time. And they had to go to Scotland. And the Scots wanted Charles II to be king because he was the legitimate next king in line. And he was a Stuart. He was a Scotsman. So the Scots wanted to bring Charles II to England. And in 1650, they brought him over to Scotland and they said, we will back you. And Cromwell said, no, you won't. And he brought the New Model Army up to Scotland. And they laid siege to Edinburgh. And some of his generals, some of his godly generals, resigned. They said, we will not fight against fellow Christians, fellow Puritans, as it were. And Cromwell said, OK, have your way, but we're going to go and punish the Scots because they are in rebellion against my legitimate authority. So he laid siege to Edinburgh Castle and he couldn't take it. Oliver Cromwell failed to capture Edinburgh Castle, which was the key to conquering Scotland. And so he had his army march away. They were getting hungry, disease. They headed back to England. The Scottish army in Edinburgh Castle said, what? You not fight us? So they left the castle and got out in the open field against the New Model Army. They chased Oliver Cromwell as he retreated out of Scotland, and then he turned on them. He couldn't believe it. Here come all these raging Scots, because there hadn't been a fight, and they wanted to fight. And he turned and he defeated them with great slaughter, all these Covenanters. And then he marched his army up to Edinburgh and walked in the gates, and Scotland was his. And you know, Scotland never had it so good as when Oliver Cromwell had put them in their place and then gave them religious freedom. For the first time, the Scots, the Scottish Kirk, the Presbyterian Church of Scotland, had free reign in Scotland because Oliver Cromwell believed in total religious freedom. He had Catholic soldiers in his army, much to the dismay and the horror of a lot of the other Puritans, especially the Presbyterians. He also had others in his army who were much less than Christian. They were radical men. And that's another story. Oliver Cromwell became the Lord Protector, and he ruled over England, and he ruled over them with great success until he died in the late 1650s. He was succeeded. Parliament turned to his son, Richard, his oldest son, and Richard was not the man that his father was. He could not rule England. And so Parliament turned to Charles II and brought him back from exile in France. And his story connects with the Scottish Covenanter story we'll talk about this afternoon. When Oliver Cromwell died, he was the most hated and the most loved person in the English-speaking world, both at the same time. And when he died, he was greatly mourned, and later on, after his enemies got control, the way the Catholic monarchs would do once they were thrown out, and then when they got back in power, is they dig up the bodies of their enemies and burn them and scatter their ashes, like that would do something to them. But I have an interesting artifact that I brought. I'm going to end with this. For those who want to see what Oliver Cromwell looked like, when Oliver Cromwell died, it was a common practice in those days to make a plaster cast of the face of a dead king or a dead general for posterity's sake. And when Cromwell died, they made a plaster cast, a mask of his face in death. And that plaster cast, someone took and made a few copies of it. And I have one of them with me. Now, it belongs to Dr. Moorcraft, so we don't want to break it. It is an absolute treasure. Now, we're not Catholics. We're not worshiping the mask of Oliver Cromwell. And it's not some kind of Halloween trick. But this actually is the death mask of Oliver Cromwell. And you'll never see another one in your lifetime. So anyway, I brought it so you could see it. And I'll set it up over here on the table. And with that, let me say that Oliver Cromwell himself was the perfect example of a man, a very humble man, who was raised to the heights of glory in his nation. But a man who gave glory to God and sought to obey God in everything he did. Now, he was imperfect and he made mistakes. But he was a great man that God used really to change history.